AstraZeneca vaccine rejected by much of Europe as airlines skyrocket higher and tech leads the market up, even as inflation fears continue to weigh on risk assets. Welcome to the Daily Briefing. I'm Jack Farley. For all of this and more, I'm joined by Real Vision Managing Editor Ed Harrison.
Ed, welcome back to the Daily Briefing. How are you doing?
I am okay. I'm still a little dazed after daylight savings time for those in Europe, which hasn't shifted over yet. We shifted the clock forward. We sprung forward an hour, and it was a rude awakening for me today in particular.
Yeah, a little bit of a slap in the face, but you know, sometimes you need that inspiration to really focus on the market. So, Ed, what did you think of the price action today? You know, pretty flat in the indices, the NASDAQ ending up just barely over 1%. But one thing that I noticed, Ed, was that the airlines were up a great deal. United Airlines up 7%, American Airlines up almost 8%, and just that the Jets ETF up a great deal as well. What do you make of that price action?
Yeah, so I mean, the reflation trade is still playing out to a certain degree. I was just looking across different markets. We know that Europe, we can talk to that later. We saw the bonds rally there on the back of some AstraZeneca vaccine problems. Crude was flat. Gold and silver were up today. Looking at that, you know, you talked about the indices, the Dow, you know, 50 basis points, S&P just 63 basis points. It was relatively flat. It was somewhat of a calm day, and I think that there was no real direction other than what you talked about in terms of the airlines, the U.S. Reflation, people, you know, looking forward to the reopening. That rotation is still sort of happening.
Yeah, just to give a little color on the airlines, so the TSA, they give their numbers out every day on the checkpoint, the number of total travelers that go through their checkpoint, what they call the throughput. And if you look at this, the black line is that number, and we're at 1.34 million that was on Sunday yesterday, and that annoyingly yellow bright line is the 20-day moving average. So you can see that we are the airline industry is staging somewhat of a recovery. There also were some polite, some good noises coming out of the airline CEOs. I think it was the JP Morgan Industrials Conference. The Delta today released a filing saying that their average daily cash burn is only going to be $12 to $14 million per day for March, which was lower than they thought. So things are looking pretty good for the airlines. At least that was how the market perceived it today. But Ed, you talked about Europe. Do you want to pivot there now? Because I know you've been following this AstraZeneca story like a hawk, and things are really getting very serious. Do you want to quickly just tell the people at home what's going on there?
Yeah, you know, even before I get there, let me tell you that I think it's funny that, you know, we're talking about a cash burn. And we're talking a cash burn of 12 to 14 million, and that's supposed to be good news. I mean, incrementally it is, which is how things move at the margin, but it doesn't really tell us what the new normal for the airlines is going to be. I really strongly suspect that, you know, those people buying $5,000 and $7,000 and $10,000 tickets for business class are going to be missing relative to the sorts of people who are, you know, going to Cancun for vacation. So the jury's still out as to whether or not this rally is for real over the longer term. But on AstraZeneca, you know, basically there are two things that are happening. One is that the AstraZeneca vaccine in particular has run into problems. It's not just problems in Europe where there are doubts about whether it causes problems for health, but also in South Korea, I've seen that there are things of that nature as well. But then there's also the European ability to roll these things out as aggressively as has been done in the US and the UK. And the European rollout of the vaccine has been marred both by the inability to get enough people vaccinated, but also by what I would consider fear of the existing vaccines that are available. And interestingly, there's been some commentary that some non-EU forces, Russia as an example, are helping to foment a certain level of fear and discord within the EU in order to make sure that things go as poorly as possible, because they look at the EU as a strategic rival and they want to make sure that things are not going quite according to plan. That's something that a lot of people haven't been talking about, but there are rumblings of this happening, that the discord is actually being amplified by external sources.
Yeah, Ed, you're absolutely right. I think that this really could be a turning point for the vaccine, because you look at the countries in Europe that have suspended the use of the vaccine: France, Italy, Germany, Spain has suspended some regions have suspended, even Bulgaria, Latvia, Norway, Ireland, Iceland. So really, there aren't that many countries left in Europe that are allowing this vaccine. Obviously, this will hamper the vaccine efforts to vaccinate the broader public and inoculate them against this virus. How significant do you think it will hamper them, given, there are other ones? There is Pfizer, there is Moderna, but they're having some supply issues. How bad do you think the damage could be from this?
I think that it could be bad enough that it really delays the reopening for Europe as compared to the U.S. or the U.K., for sure. And, interestingly, if you look, Axios had an article that came out today, about 2 hours ago. They said that 49% of Republican men and 47% of 2020 Trump supporters said that they won't be vaccinated if it's available to them, okay? So even though we have numbers that are really high in the United States, where people actually have said point blank, we're not gonna get vaccinated, we still have a rollout that is better. So from a bureaucratic perspective, the Europeans just aren't getting it done. And that makes you think, given their desire or ability to lock down, that we're not out of the woods yet in terms of another wave. We're not out of the woods yet in terms of problems for Europe's economy. So Europe looks to be a laggard in all of this. That's my takeaway there. And let's also remember that countries like Italy have said, no way, no how, even though we're not using our vaccines, can you export our vaccines to the likes of Australia? There are bans in terms of the Europeans trying to hold on to their vaccine. Even the United States is holding on to the AstraZeneca vaccine, even though we haven't actually okayed AstraZeneca for use in the United States as yet. But we're still holding on to our supply in case we do.
Ed, I want to move on to bonds and inflation versus deflation. You had a report today off of credit write-downs. It's hot off the presses. And you had some thinking there about how the market is reacting to different inflation expectations. What do you see going forward?
Over the last week or so, I haven't written and I've been thinking about what's been going on in the markets. And there are three narratives that were playing out in my mind. One was the one that you talked about, the inflation versus deflation. There's also the end of cycle versus the beginning of cycle narrative. And then there's the institutional versus the retail investment narrative that we can go through. The first one, inflation deflation, has been playing out for me, first and foremost, in terms of bonds. I spoke to Katie Stockton, who's a technical analyst, a few weeks ago, and she pointed out a 114.25 level, if I remember the number, as a point of resistance in the market between a channel of 1% and 150 on the US 10-year. And she said basically that the technical indicator she was looking for were, it was two Friday closes above that level. And then you would see bonds consolidate above that level, move to the top of the range at 150. And this is exactly what happened. In fact, it was interesting, the close, the second close was well above the 114.25 level. And then the next support level was in the 150 level. And we closed for the second time above 150, the second Friday, last Friday. And we're now at 160. So we're trading well above that support level. So we're in a new trading range at this point in time. So when I think about inflation and deflation, I'm thinking about the fact that inflation expectations are rising and that it's having a very big impact on the steepening of the yield curve, where the rates at the short end are pinned at zero as a result of the Fed's policy. But people, because they're expecting inflation, and therefore they're expecting that the Fed will be preemptive in some capacity relative to what they're saying, the yield curve is steepening. And that's ultimately probably bad for equities, especially technology growth and things of that nature.
Ed, when you said the word preemptive, could you explain to me and to the audience what you mean there? Because I noticed in your piece today, you really underscored how up until this point, the Fed has been a fundamentally reactive institution. In other words, once things go extremely badly, such as in March when you had the stock market absolutely crash, then the Fed comes in droves. But it's not really an anticipatory institution. Could you just shed some light on the difference between reactive and proactive or preemptive?
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, so I'm thinking of a reactive, proactive, as in what causes the Fed to do whatever it does. So if it's reactive, it's basically the market's forcing the Fed into action, versus proactive is that the Fed gets out in front of the narrative that the market's playing, and they actively try to build a narrative that the market will support, which is not what they're doing now. The market's resisting the Fed. They're front running the Fed. And so when I think about preemptive, what I'm saying is that the Fed, it has said to us that inflation, it won't fire until it sees the whites of inflation's eyes. But in reality, the market is saying, we don't believe you. We think that you will preempt inflation. You'll see 2% inflation, 3%. You'll see things gathering pace, and you'll be scared, and you will react as a result. At a minimum, you'll see we, the market, forcing you into that position, and so you will react. So I think that they'll move into sort of the inflation preemptive mode at some point in time, but only after something in the market breaks, only after the market forces them to take action, because the Fed is a naturally reactionary force.
Let's get into that, Ed. When you said when something breaks, what is the thing that is going to break? You know, commodity prices are getting very rich. Inflation expectations are getting very rich as well. But that's not really a market crash. So where is the chink in the armor that's going to force the Fed to intervene, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when people talk about the Fed put, a lot of times they're talking about equities. But when the Fed is talking about the tightening of financial conditions, they're not necessarily thinking about equities first and foremost. They're thinking about credit. And so I think that it's breaking in terms of the tightening of financial conditions, which necessarily means that you have some level of closing of the credit markets. That's what would cause the Fed to react. And we did see that in December of 2018. And to a degree, you could say it comes hand in hand with what happens in equities. And then finally, of course, there's the real economy. You know, there's a nexus of the real economy, equities, and credit all happening together in some capacity. If you think about, as an example, the NASDAQ bubble bursting, was it the fact that the Fed was raising rates that caused a steepening of the yield curve that eventually caused a problem to roll over into equities bursting and then the economy fell? Or was it a natural sort of bubble that burst and then that fed over into the real economy and then we had a a recession in the year 2000, 2001. No one really knows. I mean, if you go back to that particular period, there's really no reason to think that, okay, definitely it was the Fed, they caused that, or definitely it was the bursting of the bubble, that's what caused the problem, or definitely it was the financial or the economic collapse, the recession that caused the bursting of the Nasdaq bubble. There's no definite cause and effect. The three interact in some capacity, and so the breakage that we might see could happen on any one of those three levels.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. So often market crashes happen, and then the narrative is applied after the fact. It's not like the crash of 1987, where the Dow Jones plummeted, 19%? People still can't really attribute it to a single cause. It's kind of asking, why did this tsunami hit this shore instead of this other shore? There's really no rhyme or reason to it, right?
And you know, I remember, I'm old enough to remember the 87 crash, and I remember that the fears of a recession or a depression were palpable. I mean, that was a massive hit, over 20% in one day. People were thinking, you know, that's it. You know, we're going to go into recession right now. And it didn't happen. There wasn't a recession until 1991. So they're not necessarily interchangeable. The real economy, the real economy, the stock market, and the credit cycle.
Okay, so Ed, we explained one lens through which you're looking at the market, inflation versus deflation or disinflation. Now, can you tell us about the role of retail traders, or how institutional traders are reacting to retail traders?
Yeah, so I think this is interesting. I spoke to Larry McDonald earlier today, and he was talking about the fact that there was an incipient move amongst institutional investors, the slow-moving institutional investors, out of the FANG-like stocks, growth stocks, if you will. And they were moving toward the reflation trade relatively late. But, you know, since they have a large percentage of the market, there's still momentum in that trade as a result of that. And they're not going to be influenced necessarily by momentum per se. So there's still some oomph left there. But at the same time, if you look at the numbers, if you look at, you know, the percentages of trades that are executed per day and who's executing them, take away high frequency trading, which is a lot of the market, and you can see a huge increase in the relative proportion of retail traders in terms of their volume. So they're increasing in terms of importance, in terms of the actual momentum of the market. And so the question then becomes, you know, who is moving this market at this point in time? Is the momentum moving as a result of what's happening with small retail investors collectively? You know, you think of GameStop as an example, which was very volatile today, by the way. Or think of, you know, what happened in August, September with the FANGs and the short-dated options that people were trading on the FANGs. So we don't know if they are moving the markets or if it's still institutional money that is creating the momentum. But there seems to be a sea change in terms of where the momentum is, and it's not clear how long that will last or whether it's emblematic of end or beginning of cycle.
Well, Ed, that's a perfect segue to my next question. The last lens through which you view this market is end of cycle versus beginning of cycle. How are you thinking about that, and what do these terms even mean to you?
Yeah, so, I mean, first and foremost, it always means credit. I'm thinking about the credit cycle. But, again, you know, there's credit cycle, there's the business cycle in terms of the real economy, and there's also, you know, bull and bear markets. And to the degree that you believe that they move together with lags, then you would think that we just had a recession and we also have had a monster rally in equities and we've had a tightening of credit spreads to a degree. All three of those are hallmarks of the beginning of cycle. But then when you look under the hood and you see some of the dynamics, what I would call signposts of cycle beginnings and ends. And when you also look at valuations, you see a completely different story. So for instance, on a valuation perspective, if you look at the Shiller PE or the cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio, very high level, the highest ever from which we would start a cyclical bull market. You look at other signposts like SPACs and IPOs that are coming in. The one we were just talking about with regard to retail investors taking over as a percentage of trading. You know, for instance, Charles Schwab, who's a retail brokerage company, they said three times as many people opened retail brokerage accounts at Schwab in February as normal. So those are all signposts of end of cycle types of dynamics. So at the same time that you might think economically because of the pandemic, we bottomed out and we're now off to the races, really, there are a lot of late cycle plays that are playing out. And one that I caught today because of David Rosenberg is interesting, which is the lag with this rotation. You know, we've been talking about the reflation trade and the rotation from growth into value as a sign of, you know, the beginning of cycle. But Rosenberg says, actually, if you think about it, we saw a topping in the NASDAQ, I think it was in January of 2000, and it wasn't until later, maybe it was March or May, that we subsequently saw the S&P 500 and the Dow top out. So it could really be that we lost the market leadership in August, September timeframe with the FANGs, because they pretty much traded flat to nowhere since that time. And we're now trying to find new leadership, but we're not being successful in doing that. So we're seeing this churning, and we're calling it the reflation trade, but really it's a sign that we're at the end of cycle. So fascinating stuff with regard to that, and it's still indeterminate what the answer is.
Really interesting. What you said about what David Rosenberg said about how the transition went from the NASDAQ was at the top, and then it plummeted. But the S&P, it didn't take until later that the S&P was at the top. That fits, because I'm actually reading a book about Enron right now, and it was the high-flying tech stocks with no revenue. It was all about eyeballs. Those were the first ones that dumped. But it wasn't until later 2001 when the telecoms dumped as well. And that's when Enron, of course, was under pressure because it had this broadband business that was supposed to be worth so much that was worth nothing. And that actually reminds me of what Milton Berg said in his interview with John Hussman. This interview was filmed maybe 1-2 months ago, before I think tech was selling off. And at the time, Milton made the point, you know, John was very bearish. Milton made the point that everything is working now. You know, SPACs are working, IPOs are working, tech is working, value is working, energy is working, real estate is working, everything. And that is not a sign of a market top. A sign of a market top is when things start to overperform relative to other things. And, oh, okay, like today, you know, the airlines are surging, but energy stalled out. You know, obviously we have the sell-off in tech, which is sort of, that's reached kind of a stasis. We unclear where it will go from there. But it's really interesting. And I actually, you know, you've got such great examples. I have an example of my own, which is a chart of the Ford Motors, their yield curve. In other words, how much it costs them to borrow, which on the y-axis is their yield, you know, what their interest payments are. So as of in the green line, as of March 15th last year, so exactly 1 year ago, it was kind of like this. And then a little over a week later, on March 25th, their yield curve went all the way up here because of the market sell-off, the pandemonium. You know, people were selling everything to sell the good in order to liquidate the bad, yada, yada, yada. As well as also on March 25th, I believe S&P Global downgraded their bonds from BBB- to BB+. So Ford officially was not just a fallen angel, which is the phrase, but the biggest fallen angel. So we got the green, the brown, and then today, the dark green line as of today, March 15th, 2021, yields are actually significantly lower than they were a year ago, despite the fact that a year ago they had a higher rating. So you're kind of seeing that renewal of, you know, yields blowing out and then going back to normal, but you're not seeing that rejuvenation of credit quality. So it has the trappings of a beginning of cycle. So the question is, you know, if it quacks like the beginning of a cycle, is it a bidding of a cycle? Because it's just so complicated. What are your thoughts there?
As you were saying that, I was thinking about the FANG, and I was thinking about the retail investor craze that happened at the end of the summer. So at the end of the summer, there was a people were talking about, I think it was SoftBank, and the fact that they had this trading strategy, this option strategy. But it also later turned out there was a huge spike in terms of short-term options, similar to what we're seeing with the meme stocks like GameStop and AMC. And that was driving a lot of the action in the large cap tech space. So Amazon, Facebook, Apple, companies like that. And if you look at the price charts for all these companies since that time, I was just doing that. Every single one of them, except for Google, has topped out over the last 6 months, ever since that episode happened. So you look at Facebook's chart. Facebook went all the way up and it topped out in September. At like 280 some. Now it's down to 273. It's been relatively flat during that time. You look at Amazon. Amazon topped out exactly the same time, the beginning of September. It topped out at 3,300. Now it's at 3,800. So it's down relative to that period of time. Same thing with Apple. Google is the only one of those four that I've looked at really briefly that has gone up since that time. So the old leadership is dead. So if you think about it, March 2020, that was when we had a new bull market. But yet we had this rally, the reopening rally that was snuffed out in September. And since September, we now need new leadership, literally 6 months into this new cycle. So to me, it's still indeterminate. So that's what I would say is it's almost like the 80-82 double dip recession. That is that, if you think of March 2020 as the equivalent of, mid-1980, suddenly we had a resurgence a year later and everyone was excited. But then we had another, a second dip later on. And so then the market rolled over. So to me, it's almost as if we need more time to really figure out where this market is going. And in the meantime, you have to place your bets. You have to stay in the market. You have to decide where you're going to be between now and when you get that certainty as to, how you're going to allocate your assets. If I had to place my bets, I would place them in terms of over the short term, the market's probably going higher. But I think over the medium term, there are more headwinds and that you probably need to hedge against some serious downside risk because the momentum could shift very sharply. So yeah. I think that's my explanation there.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that that is a strategy worth considering about, okay, you have these holdings that are long all of the factors that are at play right now, such as growth, momentum, and the like. How can I, buy a hedge that will protect myself if things go bad? So, perhaps you want to buy a put option on some of the high flying growth stocks that really, they're growing a lot, but they haven't established market dominance yet. Ed, you mentioned the FANG stocks have kind of been trading in a range since last summer. You're absolutely right. And, Facebook is down since then. And I was thinking of, I forget if it was late January, early February, but Facebook reported results, and they were phenomenal. For a mature company, they were growing their revenues at 30% per year, and the stock kind of just continued to trade in that range. So I guess that shows just how high the expectations were going into it, whether the market's pricing in there were going to be some regulatory concerns. But Ed, I want to go to another chart, as you know, we only have a few minutes left, which is the chart of the 10-year inflation break-even versus the 5-year inflation break-even, and then the black line is the spread between them. So normally, the 10-year inflation break-even, that is the market's expectations of inflation for the next 10 years, is higher than the 5-year inflation. And that kind of makes sense. It's kind of like the yield curve, but for inflation. The market, you know, thinks that inflation will rise for a marginal year. However, this time, that spread has gone negative. And it's actually the lowest that I've been able to record it since 2003, meaning that 32 basis points of more inflation for the 5-year than the 10-year. And to me, Ed, that confirms the mainstream narrative that inflation is coming, but it's going to be temporary. It's going to be cyclical. It's not going to be secular. And actually, that's what Raoul voiced to Ash on the Daily Briefing on Friday, that yes, inflation is coming, but you know, I still am a big believer in secular disinflation. What do you make of that view that inflation is going to be cyclical? And what do you think of the chart?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, it's interesting how you didn't say transitory, because you wanted to avoid sounding like you were Jay Powell in the Fed. But I agree with the concept that the secular disinflation is still at play, and that there's nothing that I've seen that makes me think that after a brief period of time, that won't overwhelm some of the transitory forces, some of which are supply side shocks from receding. So, you know, once you get through these bottlenecks, these supply side bottlenecks, things will be back to normal. And that's where there's going to be moderate disinflation. And that's pernicious to a certain degree, unless you have wage inflation, which, you know, which is where you get real inflation, because, you know, it's inflation in the things that you need, but disinflation in the things that you want. And the less money you have, the more things you need relative to your income. It's the people who have the most income who, relative to their income, they have a much smaller percentage of the things that they need, and then they can buy the things that they want where the disinflation is. So that sort of creates an opportunity for inequality to continue to flourish. You know, I was thinking during this whole thing about Mark Cuban, actually. You know, Mark Cuban put on this collar. So when you were talking about the puts for the high flyers, I mean, one way to structure it is to say, look, you know, I think there's limited upside here over the medium term. I think that if, you know, I see so much speculation, I'm willing to give up some of the upside for the positions that I have by taking off the downside of these positions. So, you know, I will, you know, sell out of the money for these calls, but then I will use that premium in order to buy these puts that are also out of the money. So that means that I'm collared in this range, so that, you know, I put my shares to you, you know, if I get 20-30% upside, but if I get 30% downside, then I'm taken out of that position, and that's the maximum loss that I can take. So it's that kind of situation that we're in now. And, you know, if that's really where we are, you know, Cuban, he timed the market pretty well, because ultimately, you know, you had the blow off top and he got taken out of his position, but he didn't get any of the downside.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It sounds like a phenomenal trade. Mark Cuban's obviously an incredibly smart guy. I might, you know, just a little, give it a little advice to the audience. Go and if you want to know whether you should be selling calls, go and look at your bank account. And if you don't see three commas, don't sell calls. But I'm just kidding. Ed, as we reach to a close, I just really, really quickly want to say that I did an interview with financial historian Jamie Catherwood that comes out tomorrow, and he touches on a lot of these themes that we've been talking about, Ed, that are so important now. But so many people say, oh, this is unprecedented. Well, he shows it's not unprecedented. Retail fervor, not unprecedented. He talks about the bucket shops where you could basically have margin 20 to 30 to 1 and bet on a single stock, and it would really, you know, be more similar to playing blackjack than it was actually investing or allocating capital. He also has a very interesting analogy between non-fungible tokens and, you know, things going on sale for $70 million, and he compares it to collectibles throughout history about how, you know, wealthy Victorian, in Victorian England, wealthy merchants would pay, you know, tens of thousands of dollars just for shells. And that's how actually Royal Dutch Shell was called that, because the founder was a collector. And he also compares it to how samurais were basically paying, you know, hundreds of yen for rabbits from Western traders during the Meiji Restoration, and how, you know, so like the most expensive rabbit went for 600 yen at a time when the average monthly rent was 0.5 yen.
And, you know, so they, as they say, the past is prologue. That's what I would say with that. I love financial history. And let me finish it off by, as you said that, I actually have the numbers from Mark Cuban, what he did, to give you an example of it. So Mark Cuban says that Yahoo, which is what he received 14.6 million shares of Yahoo trading at $95 at the time. So what he did is, for each 100 shares of Yahoo stock, you know, one contract of a put at a strike of 85, he bought that. And then he one contract of a call with a strike of 205, which is much higher, he sold that. So in total, there were 146,000 of these contracts of calls and 146,000 contracts of puts that he traded. And the premium from the put exactly offset the premium of the call. So there was zero cost to the trade. And so zero cost, he sat there. He had a very limited opportunity set. And this was a three-year option. These options expired in 3 years. And when the option period was over, he was out of the position and he was a billionaire.
Wow, what a trade. Well, Ed, I know we're running over, but really quickly, this kind of captured the news cycle today. Tesla released a corporate filing saying that it officially, effective as of March 15th, 2021, the titles of Elon Musk and Zach Kirkhorn have changed to Techno King of Tesla and Master of Coin, respectively. So what do you think about that? The CEO is now the Techno King of Tesla, and the CFO, Chief Financial Officer, is now the Master of Coin. Your thoughts, Ed?
Past is prologue again. You know, .com. I add .com to my name, and then suddenly I'm worth more. I mean, Elon Musk is thinking that somehow I can make myself a crypto king, and then that's going to make my company a different company. But we see the chart. Tesla peaked much higher. I don't think it's coming back.
Mm. Well, Ed, a bold call. I would tend to think that you could be right. Very compelling reasons to think you're right. I want to have Jared Dillian back. You know, he, about a month ago, made that call, and he could not have been timed better. But Ed, thanks so much for joining, as always. Great to have you.
Yeah. Very nice, Jack. Good to talk to you.